It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Central Time, we'll learn about breakthroughs in bioengineering that are letting people regrow parts of fingers, see through their ears, and push the limits of medicine. We'll talk to the author of The Bodybuilders. First, the use of high-capacity wells has been a contentious issue around Wisconsin, oftentimes pitting farm owners against environmentalists and owners of shoreline property. These wells are able to pump upwards of 70 gallons of water per minute. Farm owners say they're necessary for their crops. Others say they harm rivers and other water sources. And these arguments were on full display at a crowded Capitol hearing yesterday as lawmakers consider loosening some high-capacity well regulations. Laurel White is with us now to talk about those hearings. She's state Capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News. Laurel, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, first of all, what are the regulations at play here?
So this bill is very similar to a bill that we saw at the tail end of the last legislative session. Actually, it's identical to a bill we saw at the tail end of the last legislative session. This is a proposal that would make it possible for owners of high-capacity wells to repair or replace an existing well without having to apply for a new permit. So if you're one of those farmers that has a high-capacity well on your property and it has some issues, it needs some repairs done, or you want to make an entirely new well for whatever reason, you can go ahead and do so without receiving permission, basically, from the State Department of Natural Resources.
Now, this isn't about the raw number of wells in Wisconsin. This isn't about building new wells. So it might sound like a fine point, but it sounds like this hearing was actually pretty lively.
It was. This subject has been very contentious since it's been around, and this is something that's been circulating in the Capitol really for years. But it has been something that Republicans, who are the sponsors of this measure, haven't even really been able to get on the same page because there are so many kind of wonky and complicated elements to the bill. But it seems like everybody in that party has a unified force now with this particular piece of legislation. They're ready to go. And that hasn't meant, though, that we haven't had some drama in the Capitol. It was a very animated hearing yesterday. It kicked off at 9 a.m. And we don't see this very often. They actually had to set a limit and say, we are going to finish by 6 p.m. And they had dozens of people testifying and a line actually going out the door of the committee room in the morning right away. And I'm not sure if they actually ever did this, but they talked about setting up an overflow room where folks that were interested in the hearing could go and watch via a live stream if they couldn't physically fit into the committee room.
So it was a high-capacity hearing.
It was. It was indeed.
You gave us some of the sound from this hearing. Can you set up first somebody who spoke in favor of the proposal? Set that up for us.
Sure. So as we mentioned before, a lot of farmers utilize these high-capacity wells. Oftentimes, it's large-scale vegetable farms or dairy farms. So we had quite a few farmers testifying in support of the bill yesterday. And one of those was a gentleman named Robert Gentner, and he's a potato farmer from Anago. And here's what he had to say.
Seems to me that to require a person to make a new application just to repair a well would be like asking a car owner to apply for a new automobile registration when he needs to repair or replace the radiator in his car.
So is this the general line of argument here? We've got these wells in place already. We're not adding new wells. So why make us restart from scratch?
That's certainly one of the arguments. I think another one of the primary arguments for proponents of this legislation is that it really provides stability to these agricultural businesses that argue the wells are essential to their survival. So for folks that might not be familiar, these wells are used for things like irrigation, if the rain isn't consistent, and farmers argue that they can lose a lot of valuable crops even in a day if they're not able to irrigate with the use of these wells. Dairy farms use them. I thought this was kind of an interesting fact as someone who's not incredibly well-versed in dairy farming. They use these high-capacity wells in part to blow mist on cows in the summertime when it's very warm. So there are a lot of uses for these wells, and farms say if they're not able to have the stability of keeping them, repairing them, because there's the danger that their license could be revoked if they have to reapply for a repair or a placement or something like that, that their businesses couldn't continue to survive.
Talking to Laurel White, state capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio, looking at yesterday's legislative hearing on high-capacity wells in Wisconsin. We heard the argument for this legislation that would make it easier to repair, replace wells. You also have some audio from a person arguing against that proposal. What set that up for us?
Sure. So there were dozens of other folks on the other side saying that this would be a really harmful piece of legislation for the state of Wisconsin. These are regular citizens. There were a lot of representatives of different environmental groups. And the clip that I have here is someone who kind of crosses both of, or I guess fulfills both of those categories. She's a citizen who says she has a river in her backyard that sees the impact of a high-capacity well nearby, and she's also a board member of an organization called the Sustain Rural Wisconsin Network. So this is Christy Greening.
When the high-capacity wells kick on across the Portage County line, which is about a half mile down the road, within 24 hours, I can see the difference in the 10 Mile Creek in my backyard.
And that's one of the big concerns about these high-capacity wells, new and existing, the idea of drawdown of groundwater, but also of surface water, as she was talking about there.
That's right. So opponents are really concerned that if high-capacity wells continue to exist and are allowed to proliferate, that lakes are going to be depleted, rivers are going to be depleted. And another argument that they make is that this is really an economic issue. It's not just people who have maybe rivers and lakes in their backyards that they use for pleasure, which is certainly an argument that they make, but also that depletion of those resources could hurt Wisconsin's tourism industry. So they're saying it's not necessarily industry versus personal interest, but industry versus industry in this debate.
Did we get any indication of where lawmakers stand on this issue?
Well, as I mentioned before, this has been a complicated issue for Republicans to get on board with. We had the same bill in the last legislative session. It made it out of the Senate, got to the Assembly, couldn't get out of the Assembly. The Assembly actually passed a slightly modified version, which then didn't get back to the Senate. So there's been a lot of back and forth in the past, but it seems for this particular instance this year with this bill that Republicans are on board. So we're expecting this to come up in the Senate. Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald said yesterday he expects to call it as early as next month. And we believe that Republicans are on board. And of course, they have the majority in the Senate. So we're expecting it to get out of there.
And that's the Senate side. Is there an indication that the Assembly will pass not just a bill on this, but the same bill so they can advance it to the governor?
You know, I haven't spoken with the majority of Assembly Republicans or gotten a sense of where their caucus is on that. The same bill is in existence in the Assembly, and the Assembly sponsor testified yesterday. So as I mentioned, the Assembly passed a different version of this last year. So I guess it's yet to be seen if we kind of reach the same hiccup there. But the general consensus, I think, is, you know, there has been some unity, and the Senate sponsor is optimistic about it getting out of that chamber.
We'll leave it there for now. Laurel, thanks as always for joining us.
Thanks, Rob.
That's Laurel White, state capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio. She joined us to talk about a hearing held yesterday over proposed high-capacity well regulations in the state. By the way, coming up later this hour, we'll take a look at threats facing groundwater supplies across the globe. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, groundwater is a vital resource to people around the globe, but in many places it's endangered by contamination or overuse. We'll talk to the authors of a new book that takes a look at the threats facing groundwater. Right now, scientists are hacking into the human body to help people with debilitating conditions. They're using bioengineering to do things that were once thought impossible, things like designing bionic limbs, regrowing parts of fingers with stem cells, and helping a blind person see with her ears. Ideas that sound like science fiction or the plot of a Hollywood thriller are now becoming reality in research labs around the country. Adam Puri joins us now. His new book is The Bodybuilders, Inside the Science of the Engineered Human. Adam, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Rob.
I want to meet one of the central characters in your book, somebody who is taking advantage of this technology himself and helping pass it on to others. Hugh Hare, am I saying that right, at MIT. Tell us his story.
Yeah, it's a really incredible story, and it's actually one of the ways that I got into this book. He was a champion rock climber. At 16 or 17, he was one of the best athletes on the East Coast. And he had very little interest in school, though. He was like a C and D student. But then, he was hiking Mount Washington, him and a friend, and they wandered into the wilderness and got lost, and they almost died. And his legs were amputated below the knee, both legs, and he became a double amputee. And the doctors told him he'd never walk again, never run, never climb, but he started tinkering with his prosthetics so that he could bring them on the climbing wall, making them into 7-foot-long prosthetics and, you know, little blades that he could climb. And he became even a better climber than he was before. And, then when he got on the ground, it was very uncomfortable walking. So he started taking engineering classes, and now he's a leading by engineer. He became a straight-A student. And basically, he's figured out a way to reverse engineer the human leg. That's one of the things that is driving this revolution is we now have the processing power to analyze things like that. You know, there's about 200 bones, 700 muscles in the leg, and he's figured out how they relate to each other. It's, the leg is basically a complex web of tendons and muscles that juggles energy and recycles it, and he's replicated that with a bionic limb. So it's a pretty inspirational story, and it's helping a lot of people.
And when I think of prosthetics, I often think of an inert shape of matter. And this is incredibly high tech. There is hardware, and there's really complicated software that enables him to walk. I think you wrote that if you didn't know, you wouldn't have known.
Right. I mean, well, every once in a while, there was a little squeaking noise, as the gears went by. But, yeah, he's walking, and he actually, one of the things that was amazing is just he was telling me when he first lost his legs, he used to wake up, he'd be dreaming of running through the cornfield behind his house with the wind in his hair, and then he'd wake up, and he thought he'd never run again. And now he jogs Walden Pond every day on prosthetic limbs. It's pretty incredible. And, what we're seeing with that, we don't have the signal processing power yet to, for instance, totally replicate the billions of neurons, what they're doing. But this is sort of a preview of what we'll be able to do as computing power, sensing, and all these things advance in other areas of the body.
And Hugh is kind of an example of both sides of the story you're telling. On the one hand, people who have what we would consider a disability or a condition that would limit their lives, doing their best to not accept that limit. And on the other hand, the scientists and researchers who are trying to work around what we thought were the limits of our human engineering and technology.
Yeah, there's so many moving stories that I came across while working on this book. People who hadn't seen and could suddenly see again. And with Hugh Hurt, a lot of people, when they come in with their family members and they try on these limbs, and it really feels to them like they're walking again. And, people cry. It can be a very emotional experience. These types of things weren't possible just a few years ago.
Yeah, tell us the story. You mentioned seeing again. Tell us the story of the woman who could see through her ears.
Yeah, she's another amazing one. That's my mother's favorite story in the book, actually. She wanted to be a vet, and she was working in a grenade factory, actually making grenades to save up money. And she loved nature. And then there was this industrial accident and an explosion, and she lost both her eyes, and she was blinded, this woman named Pat Fletcher. And then one day, years later, she was surfing around the Internet, and she came across this program that claimed it could convert pictures into sounds, and she didn't think it would work. She thought it was funny, but when she tried it kind of blew her mind. And what it does is it takes the pixels of a picture and it converts them into sounds. Our brain is actually capable of processing, scores of different sounds at the same time. And it does so in a consistent pattern, and over time her brain learned to recognize these patterns, and it actually routes the patterns of what she calls soundscapes to her visual cortex. She's been they've scanned her brain at Harvard Medical School, and actually if they jingle keys next to her ear, they can see that that sound is routed to her auditory cortex. But with the soundscapes, it actually goes to the visual cortex. So in a sense, she's seeing. And, when she was telling me a story about standing in the middle of the desert, looking out with the guy who invented the thing. They were looking out, into the horizon, and she said, "What are those things out there?" And he said, "Mountains." And she started to cry because she, you know, she loved mountains. And then she actually regained depth perception. So that's an example of what they call neuroplasticity, which is, you know, the ability of the brain to change. A lot of times, you know, for decades, scientists thought you needed, you know, to create a new set of eyeballs or a new ear that's exactly replicates the way that we get the sensory stimuli into the brain. But it turns out if you can just get it into the brain somehow, they call these devices sensory substitution, the brain can learn to recognize these patterns because it's a very sophisticated pattern recognition machine.
And that's another takeaway, I think, from your book, that people are starting to think in innovative ways. Instead of how do we build a new eye, it's how do we create this visual information in a different way. And for Hugh Herr, it wasn't how do I create a leg, it's how do I create something, no matter what its shape like or functions like, that meets or exceeds what I would have done with a leg.
Yeah, I mean, but the thing that was amazing about Hugh Herr and that I kept coming across with the book is that, and, you know, I set out, in a certain sense, I was interested in just human augmentation. I'd been hearing about all these crazy science fiction things, and I just wanted to know, you know, is that really possible? You know, what is really possible? So I'm a reporter, so I went out and started trying to find out what people were doing, how it was affecting people's lives. But the things that were the most amazing were the things that actually unleashed untapped resilience. And for Hugh Herr, he was sort of doing these augmentation things, like making these really big long legs and tiny little blades that could fit into crevices and things like that. But when he started to study the solutions, the ones that he found that worked best were in nature. You know, they've been honed over millennia through evolution. So, like, you know, he's, you know, when I talk about him, it's a way to just get into what we've learned about how the human body works. You know, our legs are these very sophisticated springs, and the ankle is actually kind of a motor. So that's one of the reasons that amputees have back problems and stuff, because it doesn't, you know, those inert prosthetics don't really replicate the reality. But he's able to just sort of figure out how the tendons and the muscles juggle energy and then release it. I think we recycle something like 60% of the energy with every stride. So that's pretty interesting. And that's, you know, it's a sublime solution that nature's come up with.
Talking to Adam Peori about his new book. It's called The Bodybuilders: Inside the Science of the Engineered Human. And Adam, I think when people think of engineered humans, they might turn to, might think of genetics, first of all. And you talk about that through the example of muscles. Can you tell us what's out there when it comes to the potential for building more muscle, maybe for people who really need it, maybe for people who just want it?
Yeah, well, so that's the thing. Like, you know, a lot of our qualities, like intelligence, are based on multiple genes, right? So we can't, even though there's this revolution in genetic engineering, we still don't totally understand how all the myriad genes work together to do something like intelligence. We don't have the signal processing power yet. But with muscle, there's this one mutation that they found, and it's basically for what they call a negative regulator of muscle. So when this protein is expressed, it makes muscle growth stop. So if you have a mutation that blocks this protein, your muscle keeps growing to a certain extent. And I was writing about, you know, a few years ago, there was they've known about this for a while in dogs. You know, there's what they call bully whippets, and there's also these cows that are tremendously double muscled, and because they lack this. And then, you know, sure enough, people had speculated that there must be somebody with that mutation in humans, and a baby was born in Germany that they called Super Baby. And then I talked to somebody from Muskegon, Michigan, and their son, you know, he actually pulled himself up into a what they call an iron cross, like this gymnast move where you form a human T, when he was under a year old. And they thought, wow, that's crazy. You know, so they think he has a mutation that has knocked out this negative regulator called myostatin. And it's a promising cure or it could help people who have muscular dystrophy or other muscle diseases. It could just forestall, you know, their diseases are mutations in other proteins, but they basically destroy their own muscle. So this would help slow that process, and also an age-related wasting. So there was I profiled this guy in that chapter, also named Lee Sweeney, who was at the University of Pennsylvania, and he was inspired by the people he talked to at conferences for you know, families with children who had Duchenne's muscular dystrophy, but also by his grandmother who had, you know, her muscle had, you know, we all have muscle wasting and bone thinning as we get older, and she had eventually become bedridden and sort of lost the will to live. So he was looking at this as a way to cure muscle wasting in the elderly. And he created what they called Schwarzenegger mice and Schwarzenegger dogs. And I think there are some clinical trials for Duchenne's, but at the same time, there's, you know, all these weightlifters, and, you know, as soon as this news came out, he got phone calls from all around the country from people who wanted to become human test subjects, including a coach of a high school football team, strangely enough, his secretary was telling me, and he was just besieged. So now he's on the World Doping Authority panel as well. He's trying to cure muscular dystrophy on one hand using this technique, or at least treat it, and also prevent it from being abused by athletes because, you know, steroids were actually therapeutic at first before they became.
And briefly, Adam, as we wrap up, we've looked at a few different examples. I mean, the frontier is wide open, both for using this bioengineering to help people with serious diseases and other conditions, and maybe for people without those conditions who are looking to soup themselves up in one way or another.
Right, yeah. I mean, we were talking about Pat Fletcher. I mean, one of the people who scanned her brain, he's actually trying to convert that device into what he calls a James Bond. He calls it, I forget, something about James Bond. And instead of turning you know, visual pixels into sound, he would actually turn infrared pixels into sound, and then maybe you could see through walls. You know, so that's one example.
Wow.
All sorts of cool science fiction stuff, you know. And Hughhurst used the same biomechanic insights to build exoskeletons that can be used by able-bodied people. So it's really fascinating. I mean, my book is a lot about where our limits are, what we're finding out about what causes them, and how we might overcome them. I just found the most interesting narrative and emotional stories had to do with people regaining lost function.
And we'll leave it there. Adam, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
That's Adam Piori. His new book is called The Bodybuilders, Inside the Science of the Engineered Human. Coming up after the news, we'll talk about threats to groundwater nationwide and around the world. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we take a look at a new congressional bill that would allow employers to require workers to undergo genetic testing or risk financial penalties. First, from the water we drink to the produce we eat, much of the water that enters our lives comes from underground sources. People rely on groundwater all over the world, and it makes up about 95% of the unfrozen fresh water on the planet. But these reserves of fresh groundwater could be in jeopardy in the coming years. For decades, cities have been pumping, in many cases, too much water from the ground, causing depleted reserves. And these bodies of water are vulnerable to pollution from industrial chemicals, farm runoff, and viral contamination. Our next guests look at the global state of groundwater in their new book, High and Dry, Meeting the Challenges of the World's Growing Dependence on Groundwater. William Alley is a hydrologist and director of science and technology for the National Groundwater Association. William, welcome to the show.
Hi, Rob. It's good to be with you.
And Rosemary Alley is a veteran science writer. Rosemary, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
And Rosemary, let's start with you. Talk about this explosion in our use of groundwater really over the last century and a half as I read your book.
Well, yeah, and particularly after World War II with the centrifugal pump, when that became available for broad use, really seriously increased. I mean, as we say in the book, it was like trading in your Model T for a 8-cylinder Dodge Ram pickup. I mean, suddenly they could really start pumping large amounts of groundwater. And the groundwater pumping movement started in the developed countries, started actually in the United States on the High Plains and in California Central Valley, but spread to the developed countries and then over time spread to third world countries. But in recent decades, the consequences of overpumping and contamination are starting to catch up with us.
And William, let's get into the basics of what groundwater is technically and what an aquifer is.
Sure. So groundwater, it's pretty simple. It's water that's stored underground in fractures or pore spaces or any open spaces that are beneath the ground. It becomes most obvious to us when we put a well on, into the ground and we pump water out of it. You can also sometimes see them in places where there's springs. It's oftentimes thought of as a static water body, but it's actually this. It's an actually more dynamic depending on the system. And the aquifers are what stores, what the water stored in where it's most easily transmitted. So in some places it's very difficult to pull out the groundwater or it's poor quality, but our aquifers are where we have the best quality water and it's easiest to pull it out of the ground.
Yeah, and William, on that point, if we looked at the raw gallonage of groundwater on our planet, it would look like a really huge number, but there are a lot of reasons that a particular source of groundwater is just unusable or inaccessible. Can you talk about some of the things to just make different kinds of groundwater off limits for our use?
Sure. So it's a little bit, you mentioned the 95%. So the Great Lakes actually provide a good analogy there. I mean, you've got a massive amount of water, about 20% of the world's fresh surface water stored in the Great Lakes, yet you can only take a small portion of that out because otherwise you'd affect navigation or docks or water ecology, et cetera. So a similar type situation exists with groundwater. There's a massive amount of water, but it's, you know, if it gets too deep, it's too expensive to pump, or the water quality starts to deteriorate. If you pump groundwater, you affect streams and lakes and wetlands, so those have to be considered. In some places where you have the right kind of geology, namely clay, shale, rocks, you might have land subsidence. It really becomes a major limiting factor. And then along the coasts in particular, but not just along the coasts, you have saltwater intrusion where you pump fresh water and you start to draw in some of the saline water.
And Rosemary, I've seen articles about the coming disputes over water, whether we're talking about surface water or groundwater. These things are happening and have been happening already, right? Can you talk about some conflicts that have arisen over who gets to use groundwater and how much of it?
Well, groundwater is very poorly regulated. In fact, that's kind of an understatement. It's in many places, it's not regulated at all. And so where surface water, there tend to be very clear laws that designate who has a right to use how much and monitoring and so forth. With groundwater, generally, people feel or are the practice is that what I can access from my land, I have a right to use and as much as I want. So, of course, this is leading into a lot of conflicts as we're diminishing the resource and there's, a lot of stakeholders that are have a special interest in the resource. So it's gotten a lot more complicated in recent decades of who owns groundwater.
Talking about groundwater with Rosemary Alley and William Alley, their new book is High and Dry, Meeting the Challenges of the World's Growing Dependence on Water and Groundwater. And let's talk about the growing part of that, William. Talk about how much the use of groundwater has escalated in recent years. What kind of cities, mega cities, and other communities depend on groundwater now?
Okay. So it has grown a lot, as Rosemary mentioned earlier. No country on Earth pumps more groundwater than India. In fact, India pumps about a quarter of the groundwater pumped worldwide, actually about as much or even more than China and the United States combined. A lot of groundwater development has taken place in drier regions, such as Middle East and, of course, the western United States, but groundwater has pretty well been developed, and there are issues associated with it pretty much across the globe. And so even in nice wet places like Wisconsin and the upper Midwest there. So some of the cities that use, a lot of cities that use groundwater, some of those are, just to name a few, London, Hanoi, Tucson, Arizona, Memphis, Tennessee is 100%. On groundwater. People might be surprised since it sits on the Mississippi River. So you can look across the world, Jakarta, Indonesia, many of these cities all use a lot of groundwater.
I want to get into some threats to groundwater apart from over-pumping. Rosemary, you mentioned that there weren't a lot of regulations in place to prevent over-pumping of groundwater. Are there regulations in place to prevent various types of pollutants and contamination from getting into our groundwater?
You know, I'm really going to kick that question to Bill.
I'm sorry.
He's really better qualified to answer that.
Go for it, Bill.
So I'll go for it. So, yeah, there are. In fact, at the federal level, groundwater is regulated more water quality than by water quantities, which tends to be more of a state-level jurisdiction. So EPA has a major role in regulating and monitoring groundwater. Department of Interior, a lot of federal agencies actually have some role one way or another in groundwater, particularly U.S. Geological Survey. And then the states implement a lot of the rules, like the Safe Drinking Water Act is a major groundwater act to help make sure that the drinking water, the groundwater that people drink is regulated and safe. That's the goal anyway.
And Rosemary, can you talk about instances where, maybe in spite of regulations, we've seen problems with groundwater contamination?
Well, groundwater contamination is pretty pervasive. I mean, it's more of a localized problem. I mean, I feel like I really should kick this one to Bill, too, because he is the groundwater hydrologist, so I'm going to kick it to him. Bill, take
all right.
it.
So groundwater contamination pretty much is pervasive around, and one can think of it both in a toxic substances sense. So you have a number of places that have since become Superfund sites where people were mishandling inorganic chemicals, solvents and things like that. And so you have these plumes of highly toxic groundwater that have take a long, long time to clean up, and there's a lot of those going on around the country. And then there's the more maybe insidious problem of non-point source pollution where, and that comes from fertilizers and septic tanks and things like that where you have this pervasive amount of nitrate in particular, but not also pesticides and things like that that work their way through the groundwater system are a hazard there for drinking water, but also ultimately end up in many of our surface water systems like the Great Lakes or streams or rivers or wetlands.
Talking to William and Rosemary Alley right now. They're the authors of the book High and Dry, Meeting the Challenges of the World's Growing Dependence on Groundwater, talking about the role that groundwater plays in our everyday lives, the dangers these resources could face in coming years. And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about groundwater? Are you concerned about the future of groundwater in general around the world, in your community in particular? What would you like to see change? You can give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation in just a bit here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking to William Alley and Rosemary Alley about groundwater and the challenges it could face in the coming years and decades as pollution and climate change threatens this freshwater source. William is the Director of Science and Technology for the National Groundwater Association, former Chief of the Office of Groundwater for the U.S. Geological Survey. And Rosemary is a veteran science writer. They're the co-authors of the book High and Dry, Meeting the Challenges of the World's Growing Dependence on Groundwater. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about groundwater? What concerns do you have about it in general, in your community in particular? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right to a caller now. We've got Tom on the line in Brookfield. Tom, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, what do you think?
In Wisconsin, you know, I think one of the big elephants in the room that no one really wants to address politically, and there doesn't seem to be a lot of intestinal fortitude to deal with it, is the explosion of concentrated animal feeding operations in the state. 10 years ago, we had 50 CAFOs in the state. We now have almost 300. And they're pumping groundwater at such an alarming rate to grow crops and sand and then to liquefy raw liquefied manure and sprayed across the landscape, and it ends up in our rivers and streams creating toxic algae plumes. But no one seems to really want to address the issue of just too much manure. They want to kind of address it in kind of benign ways, but no one really wants to confront it because it's a political hot button. But it's Dr. George Kraft at UW Stevens Point has been proving that the nitrates in E. coli in the private wells in the Central Sands region is really becoming a problem. Not only that, but Kewaunee County, we're having major problems with well contamination because of agricultural runoff and the lack of enforcement and management and regulations to protect our groundwater sources from these, you know, huge manure factories in America's dairy wasteland.
Tom, thanks a lot for that call. Bill, agriculture, livestock agriculture in particular, manure, nitrates, and groundwater. Is this a big problem?
Yes, it is. It's a problem in many places. Actually, it's a major problem in Europe. The Danes and the people in the Netherlands have been dealing with this problem for a long time because they have so many pigs, for example, per capita in those countries. And it requires very careful management. Obviously, the sands that your caller was referring to are, you know, water moves very, very easily through those sands, and they tend to be less cleansing, perhaps, than some other types of environments. I don't know the exact situation of your CAFOs in Wisconsin, but I know that it is a problem in many places, and there are other issues associated with it too, in terms of just the high density of it.
Thanks for that call. And Bill, that reminds me, a point you make strongly in the book is not all aquifers are created equal. I think that might even be a chapter title. The rules that might apply to one might be very different in another climate, and especially another geology.
That's correct. So where you would, for example, you have in Wisconsin area, you have fractured dolomite, which is a water flowing through the fractures. That's an entirely different system to think about than, say, your central sand plains.
Let's bring on another caller now. Gail is with us in Fish Creek. Gail, hi.
Hi. I'm really kind of concerned. I want to know what your guests have any kind of insight on it. With the Bush administration looking at removing all kinds of regulations that we've had to protect our environment, and water being a big one, that pact that was on the Kennedy Pact, I'm trying to recall what it is, about preserving Lake Superior as being like a body of water off limits from ever being tapped. I'm concerned too because of the whole thing bringing up Nestle going around the world and with their motto of clean water is not a right, and they're buying up aquifers and water systems everywhere, and for pennies on a gallon.
Gail, thanks for the call. That brought up a lot of points. The Great Lakes Compact is more of a surface water thing, so I think we'll set that aside. But Rosemary, let's get to her other two points. First of all, are you concerned that under the Trump administration, water protections might be rolled back?
Well, you know, it's almost assuredly people are concerned about that. In spite of the fact that Trump has said, you know, don't worry, we'll be fine with the environment, there's simply no way that you can just get rid of regulations and have clean air and clean water. They're just not connected, those two scenarios. So, you know, it's a question of how much, you know, how much regulation is important with groundwater, because it's so underregulated. You know, they got a long way to go before they're going to be overregulating groundwater.
And then the caller's other question, Rosemary, she was concerned about Nestle, but in general, companies buying up rights to use water, groundwater, for commercial purposes. It's been a while, but it's been a controversy here in Wisconsin in the past, elsewhere in the world too, I imagine?
Well, I know of a case in sub-Saharan Africa where I believe it's Coca-Cola I think we're India. We're actually in India, yeah, where Coca-Cola has moved in, and they're pumping a lot of groundwater. And there's a huge social controversy about this because their water resources are very vulnerable in India. Coca-Cola has tried to sort of make up for it by doing some education programs and good PR kinds of things. But it's a real controversy. And, you know, we see this happening in many places. China, of course, is starting to get a foothold, or probably more than that at this point, in sub-Saharan Africa, with the idea of turning it into their breadbasket. There are numerous examples.
We're talking about groundwater and threats that it faces around the world. William Alley and Rosemary Alley are with us. Their book is called High and Dry, Meeting the Challenges of the World's Growing Dependence on Groundwater. We'll take another caller. Dave is with us in Iola. Dave, hi.
Hi. I just want to know if your callers have any insight on the effects of frac sand mining on groundwater. I know when frac sand mining was first started in, well, especially Wisconsin, there wasn't a lot of testing done on the effects on groundwater or air quality, for that matter. Just wondering if they have any insight on that.
Dave, thanks for the call. So, yeah, there's fracking, and people are concerned about that. And then in Wisconsin, we supply a lot of the sand that gets injected into the ground in the fracking process, Bill. Feel free to tackle either or both of those, the impact of sand mining and the impact of fracking on groundwater.
Okay, yeah, so I'm familiar, but not enough to speculate much on the mining of frac. It's a lot of the frac sand for fracking comes from Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. And I can see where that's a big issue in Wisconsin. I'm pretty familiar with the hydraulic fracturing. That's an issue that has a whole range of issues associated with it. There's been a tendency, though, to focus on the wrong issues associated with that issue. A lot of the biggest concerns related to hydraulic fracturing for oil and gas, unconventional oil and gas development, relate to spills at the land surface and things like that, and what to do with the produced waters, as opposed to contaminants somehow migrating up thousands of feet of through rocks thousands of feet. The other issue there is something called stray gas, which is where the wells tap into units that have methane, and the methane comes up the outside of the well bores and then may find its way into people's water. That's where you see people lighting faucets and things like that, although that can occur naturally also.
Dave, thanks for that call. We'll go next to David in Wisconsin Rapids. David, hi.
Hi. I was wondering if your people knew anything about the Superfunds. My family is looking at moving down by the Anniston Army Depot in Alabama, and it was put on the Superfund for contamination back in 1990, and I have no idea about the Superfunds and how long it average takes to do a cleanup on that.
David, thanks for the call. Bill, I assume, like every aquifer, every Superfund cleanup is going to be different.
Right.
Are we fixing the wrongs of the past, though, with these Superfund cleanup efforts?
Yeah, so if I'm not mistaken, the Anniston, Alabama site focuses on PCBs. That was a PCB manufacturer. That was the PCB manufacturing plant, I believe, for Monsanto for many years. It's a very contentious area. I would look into that one because it's still ongoing. PCBs basically don't break down in the environment, and so they have to be either removed somehow or just sort of left in place. So, for example, there's a huge, this is surface water, but there's a huge dredging project on the Hudson, 200 miles of the Hudson River, to try to remove the PCB legacy from that river. So the EPA maintains a site that maintains all their natural, what they call NPLs, national priority sites, and I'm sure Anniston is on there. A lot of these Superfund sites have, no real end in terms of our thinking about buying and selling property in sites, so one would want to look carefully at it. Although maybe the place that the person's talking about is far enough away from the containment area. They're obviously not manufacturing PCBs anymore there, so I'd start with EPA.
David, thanks for the call. Just about out of time. Rosemary, basically, do we need to change our attitude toward groundwater? Have we been too freewheeling with it so far?
Yeah, we definitely need to change our attitude. I mean, that's why we wrote the book, was there's nothing out there for the general reader about groundwater. And most people are just sort of vaguely aware of groundwater, and there tends to be this attitude that, you know, if I need more water for my landscaping or for my property needs, I'll just drill a well and solve, problem solved. And so we're bumping up against the end of that kind of laissez-faire attitude. So, it starts with education and people learning about this precious resource that is definitely endangered, and changing our practices accordingly.
We'll leave it there. Thanks to William and Rosemary Alley. They're the authors of the new book, High and Dry, Meeting the Challenges of the World's Growing Dependence on Groundwater. Still time to share your thoughts over at the Central Time Facebook page. yesterday here on Central Time. We tapped into an issue, you know, not a front page issue, but something that seems to have struck a chord with people. The question, are green beans finger food? Short version, I was witnessed eating them in the office without fork, without silverware one time. Got a surprisingly hostile reaction from certain colleagues. There have been online debates we've seen. We talked about it. There's much laughter. We heard from some of you. Kristen emailed. Kristen says, while I prefer to eat my green beans with a fork, my daughter loves them so much that a fork just doesn't work. She's always eaten her green beans fresh from the garden, cooked green beans with two hands. It's the most efficient way to indulge in her favorite food. A caller called in later, asked about what about edamame? That's basically a green bean that you pretty much have to eat with your fingers to crack them open there. On Facebook, Amy posted a picture of someone's hand reaching into a big bowl of what looked like cooked green beans, then a picture of someone, possibly Amy herself, eating a big handful of green beans by hand. Amy also wrote a note, yes, green beans are finger food, Rob. And Sam, in an otherwise unrelated email, added, I am still snickering at the great green bean snacking debate, smiley face. So we clearly have a movement here, people. Eat your green beans with your fingers, unashamedly at home, and most importantly, in public, at restaurants. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.